are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, actually Thursday, October 10th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a hybrid Michael and Sam Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Sarah A. Cio, Policing the Open Road, How Cars Transformed American Freedom. Turkey's president threatens that he will send 3.6 million Syrian refugees currently located in Turkey to Europe if European countries label his country's military bombardment an occupation. Turkey's military operations are much larger than expected, analysts say. Operation Peace Spring has already claimed multiple civilian lives, including 16 civilians. 33 members of the Syrian Democratic Forces were wounded. Trump, meanwhile, has amplified his despicable sellout of the Kurds by downplaying their historical role and, shockingly, getting a basic piece of history wrong. Amid reports of civilian deaths, Bernie Sanders condemns Trump giving the Turkish army permission to slaughter Kurds in Turkey. Apple removes an app that tracked the Hong Kong police helping protesters. Or I should say the app helped protesters. Apple is now helping authorities. Trump urged a top aide to help Giuliani client facing DOJ charges. Ousted Ukraine envoy expected to testify in an impeachment probe despite White House vow not to cooperate, congressional aides say. Representative Mark Pocan calls for blocking Pompeo's salary until Ambassador Sondland testifies on Ukraine. Finally, some hardball. And Donald Trump, always on the international front, defends a diplomat's wife involved in a car crash that killed a British teenager. It happens. Activists entice ICE agents to quit by finding them new jobs. Brilliant piece of activism there. The Espionage Act is again deployed against a government official leaking to the media. As the war going back to the Bush and Obama administrations against whistleblowers continues in earnest, top labor leaders say that USMCA will be defeated if a quick vote is held. And Sanders says he misspoke about scaling back rallies after a heart attack, vows a vigorous 2020 campaign. His campaign is still profoundly real, folks. If you're on the left, time to stop effing around and take it seriously. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. We've got some ads that Sam lovingly and fully crafted to get to in a minute or two. We'll talk more about Rojava. Here's the reality. The reality is that the permission given and the removal of U.S. presence is facilitating a mass slaughter conducted by a vicious Turkish regime. Rojava is not perfect. It is not a utopia. But it is a dynamic left-wing experiment, and it is a group of people that have fought enormously effectively against ISIS. We should oppose all imperialisms. Absolutely, the most powerful imperialism in the world today is the U.S. global order. This is a micro example where the greater harm is obviously the precipitous withdrawal. And we see it happening right now. which is sort of stunning that people can still build justifications or fantasies about this. Now, obviously, Lindsey Graham and other people are shedding crocodile tears. They were never serious about safeguarding the Kurds. And it may well be that the only option left for the Kurds and something that should have been supported years ago is some type of strategic alliance with Assad. I mean, this is geopolitics. The Kurds had to rely on a hegemon to secure their safety. Maybe now they have to partner with a government and a leader who's engaged in multiple crimes against humanity. But right now, the Turks are engaging in crimes against humanity and destroying an experiment which we should and must have solidarity with, again, with no equivocating nonsense and simplistic one-dimensional thinking. And, you know, yes, there's plenty of strange bedfellows. It's weird to have the same position as a Lindsey Graham for entirely different reasons. But I think it's weird that other people have apparently the same position as Tayyip Erdogan and Donald Trump for their own different reasons. This is Donald Trump today expressing his profound contempt for the Kurdish people. And again, this is historical. The Kurds are multi-sector victims. They are the victim of internal hegemonic projects which have thwarted their autonomous will, most glaringly in Turkey, but I mean also obviously in Iraq, where they were victims of genocidal actions by the Saddam government, all across that region. And now they have generated an autonomous space of leftist innovation, which is certainly not perfect, certainly has mistakes and blah, 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 blah. But I have never made a perfection the metric of anything, let alone global politics. And they're going to get routed and gutted unless something significantly changes. And this is the contempt that this disgusting, grotesque leader in the White House has for them and everybody who's supporting this action is showing.
The Kurds are fighting for their land, just so you understand. They're fighting for their land. And as somebody wrote in a very, very powerful article today, they didn't help us in the Second World War. They didn't help us with Normandy, as an example. They mentioned names of different battles. They were there, but they're there to help us with their land. And that's a different thing. In addition to that, we have spent tremendous amounts of money on helping the Kurds in terms of ammunition, in terms of weapons, in terms of money, in terms of pay. With all of that.
Okay, so first, we actually do have a minor fact check, which is not the main point, but I do want to do the minor fact check. Setting aside the Kurds traveling across Eurasian landmass to volunteer for Normandy, I think we can ignore that one. Maybe Trump is confusing it with other British colonial subjects like enforced soldiers from India who fought on behalf of the British Empire. Maybe that's what he has in mind in his fizzle brain. But there actually was support for the Kurds towards a broader global effort against Hitler's Germany. What was that, Brendan?
They were part of the Iraq levies. They were a quarter of the fighting force, and which eventually was rolled into part of the British Royal Marine Commando. Mm-hmm. And they fought in Albania, Italy, and Greece.
Wow.
So not Normandy, checkmate.
So this bloated idiot.
Sense.
This bloated, disgusting moron gets it wrong, even by the same stupid, disingenuous metrics he's using. I think it's very interesting to watch the way Trump gets played by people with actual savvy, like Erdogan. This, and again, we'll keep spelling this out. This isn't a preventative war. This isn't this is about to happen and we should deploy U.S. air power or troops. Those situations have led to catastrophic U.S. actions across the globe, so-called humanitarian intervention. But just in the same way that we need to pivot radically from a moralistic, one-dimensional airbrushing of U.S. hegemonic actions across the globe, we can still look at and deal with the world as it is and appreciate the historical irony that a U.S. troop presence was protecting, first of all, a historically repressed and genocided group by multiple Middle Eastern governments, Turkish and Arab, then also recognize that, in fact, and that, by the way, should be sufficient. That should be sufficient. The same dynamic could apply to the Kurds of northern Iraq, who have much more, I would say, Emirati politics in some respects. But it also then happens to extend to the fact that they have a dynamic and important political innovation and experiment, which is the only recognizable left in that region, not nationalist, but left. And I'm on the left, so that's who I have solidarity with. I condemn this action. I think it's disgusting. I think it's horrifying. I think it is analogous, not the same, but it exists on a spectrum of the Israeli occupation and slaughters in Gaza, with the Modi regime's attacks in Kashmir, with what's happening in West Papua, and this broader sort of formalization of this type of brutality. Who wrote that piece, that brilliant piece that Donald Trump referenced?
A man by the name of Kurt Schlichter. Will Sumner pointed this out. Schlichter wrote a column here. I'm not sure what the headline is, but this part is the relevant portion. It's also true that the Kurds would have fought ISIS anyway since their psycho-caliphate was right next door. Let's be honest. The Kurds didn't show up for us at Normandy or Incheon or Khaisan or Kandahar. The Syrian Kurds allied with us in their homeland because we have a shared common interest in wiping out the head-lopping freak show that was ISIS. Moreover, not all Kurds are not equal. The PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, are a bunch of commie terrorists who have been fighting the Turks for a long time. Well, those Reds are no friends of ours.
Well, someone's getting their Turkish talking points. I mean, look, there's actually real the SDF is definitely connected to the PKK. There's no doubt about it. And has the PKK, not the SDF, but as separate operations engaged in terrorist attacks historically in Turkey? Yes, absolutely. At the same time, do they represent a genuine aspiration for rights and autonomy? 100%. And if I can understand and think with some complexity about a group like the IRA, I certainly can about the PKK. Now, in addition to that, under the broader leadership, embracing the work of Murray Bookchin. So first of all, their demands and their suffering and their oppression, they're 100% right about. And anybody who would deny that is being chauvinist or insincere, delusional, or uninformed. And now, in the current political context, they have been a force of a dynamic, progressive experimentation. This is also another thing, though, that Kurt Schlichter apparently has on his record. Do we have this up? I don't even know who Kurt Schlichter is. I mean, I know he's, I mean, obviously he's just some other grotesque idiot, but this is a photo. It's from CBS News. A Yemeni mother fought for 17 months to overcome the U.S. travel ban and visit her sick 2-year-old son. He died only days after she arrived. And Kurt Schlichter, in the epitome of Trumpism, quote tweeted this story with, "I don't care." But, you know, I guess my question's really, though, to a lot of people. Is that frankly your same reaction to the slaughter that's taking place now by Turkey? All right. There's no elegant transition, so we'll just get to it. We'll change the mood up a little bit. Sam's got some paid consumer reports.
Folks, you know that for the better part of this program. We've been doing it for almost this iteration for 10 years. My daughter would not do anything with me. She was not excited to see me. She would not talk to me. My son is like this now. My kids just, they want nothing to do with me. That has changed in the most unlikely way. Maybe it's unlikely. Hunt a Killer is the murder mystery subscription box that immerses you in an ongoing detective experience. Myla is so psyched about this. It's unbelievable. So with every delivery, you sift through a case file, right? Full of evidence. You eliminate suspects till, of course, you crack the case, you catch the killer. Hunt a Killer gets you talking, having fun together. Myla and I anticipate when the box is coming. We're doing now multiple. They basically have, like, think about it as like a TV show, like a 6-episode TV show, seasons. And we're already talking about, like, I don't know. We may do this until she gets to college. If you're a detective that prefers to work solo, Hunt a Killer is built so that you can choose how you want to play. With 2,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot, it's no wonder Fast Company named them as one of the most innovative entertainment companies of 2019. Plus, part of the proceeds for every box goes to the Cold Case Foundation to help you fund cold case investigations. Myla and I have a board that is, you know, like a bulletin board that we put up in a room, has all this, the evidence on there. And she calls me with theories. It's fun. And the thing is, you can play with other people online if you want, but she's actually doing something that she enjoys that does not involve a screen. And that is worth $1 million. But fortunately for you, for our listeners, A, Hunt a Killer does not cost $1 million. And you can go to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. Hurry to take advantage of this offer. Embrace your inner detective. That's huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. huntakiller.com/majority.
Oh, I like when Sam throws back to me. He must have, it's better when he goes, back to Michael. And I go, thank you, Sam. All right, this is an interview that Sam just, I think this was recorded last week. Really good conversation. Policing the Open Road, How Cars Transformed American Freedom, with Sarah Aco.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program a legal historian of criminal law and procedure, the 20th century United States, teaching at the University of Iowa Law School, author of Open Road, How Cars Transformed American Freedom, Sarah Aco. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
This is a fascinating story, and it starts with let's actually start with how you came to choose this topic, because it's not the implications of the advent of the car on our law is not, you know, something that's necessarily floating around the ether, right? I mean, it's just full of unintended consequences. I don't think they contemplated beforehand, and I don't think it gets much attention after the fact. But how did you come to write about this specific topic?
Actually, I started from the end of my book. I got interested in it because I wanted to look at the history of the war on drugs. The question really started forming when I was clerking in New York City for two federal judges, and much of the criminal docket in federal courts in New York were drug cases. And so I was really interested in how the drug war shaped our criminal procedure and criminal laws. And so what I started doing is, and I was really interested in the law enforcement of the war on drugs. And so if you wanted to study law enforcement as a constitutional matter, really there is one provision that is most directly relevant to governing what the police can do, and that's the Fourth Amendment. Because the Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. And most police encounters with citizens begin with a seizure, which is a stop. A police stops someone, and immediately the Fourth Amendment kicks in. And in that encounter, a search can happen as well. And so the Fourth Amendment governs that police-citizen encounter. And so what I did, I'm a historian, so I just started reading all Fourth Amendment cases from the very beginning of U.S. history. And what I found when I pulled up all these Fourth Amendment cases in Westlaw was really surprising to me. I can go on.
Yeah, well, I mean,
surprised me. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess let's, yeah, tell us what was surprising about these Fourth Amendment cases. And then, you know, then I think we can circle back and talk about why there was a need for the development of this law, you know, in the era as cars were being introduced in a mass way. But what were those Fourth Amendment cases that were so interesting?
Well, so there's two things that really stuck out to me. One was that Fourth Amendment cases were really rare until the 1920s. Some years, some decades, there were one or zero Fourth Amendment cases in state or federal courts. They started popping up a bit more in the late 19th century, but there was an explosion of Fourth Amendment cases in the 1920s. Which goes to the topic of my book. It coincided with the mass production of cars. And when I was reading these cases from the 1920s on, so many Fourth Amendment cases had to do with car stops and searches. And so from the very beginning, I realized that this really is a story. The story of the Fourth Amendment is a 20th century history, first of all, because they were pretty rare before then. And second of all, it's a story about cars, policing cars.
That's fascinating. And let me and before we get into sort of the what the implications of the introduction of the car in such a widespread way impacted our society and policing. Give me a sense of like what the Fourth Amendment cases were before it started to involve a car. I mean, obviously, you know, it's the Fourth Amendment. It obviously was on the minds of folks when they're drawing up the Constitution. What was the original construction, or I guess impetus behind the Fourth Amendment, and why was it so underutilized? I guess, or why was there less of a need for it in, let's say, the 19th century?
Sure. So I think you're asking two questions. One was, what was the original need for the Fourth Amendment? Why did the founding fathers include the Fourth Amendment as one of the amendments to the Bill of Rights? I think that's one of your first questions, right?
Yeah.
And then the second question is about what were some of the few cases that did arise, what were they about?
Right.
That's kind of the second question. Okay. So starting with the original purpose for why the founding fathers included it, so it went back to the experience during that led up to the American Revolution. We've all studied about how American colonists protested taxation without representation, right? England imposed taxes on the American colonists. They didn't want to pay, and so a lot of them didn't pay their taxes. And so what Parliament did was they passed these general laws. They basically passed a law that allowed agents of the king to stop and search anyone, anywhere, any place. They were called general warrants that gave agents, law enforcement agents, to search for tax evasion, basically. And
the tax evasion, just to be clear, I mean, my understanding is the tax evasion was a function of basically goods that we would, you know, that would be that from the king's perspective were smuggled. So if you had
exactly.
certain goods on you that you had not paid tax on, maybe didn't have the stamp or the wax or whatever it was that indicated that you had already that you had paid taxes on these, they were contraband.
Exactly, exactly. And so what the Fourth Amendment requires is a specific warrant, right? It doesn't take away law enforcement's ability to search and to seize. What the Fourth Amendment says is if the government wants to search and seize, they need to have a specific warrant specifying who they're going to seize or arrest, what they're going to search and where they're going to search. So no more general warrants that are enacted by law. Law enforcement have to go to a judge to get out a specific warrant.
The idea being that you need to be aware that there's been a specific, you know, case of smuggling or slash tax evasion, however you want to call it, as opposed to I'm going to search every home and person and just fishing expedition at any and all times.
Exactly. What the founding fathers wanted to prohibit were general exploratory fishing expeditions. Right. And so what another requirement of the Fourth Amendment specifies is that to get a warrant, to get a specific warrant, the law enforcement needs to make out a probable cause. Right. There's a reason why they want to look at certain places or to make an arrest. They have to articulate probable cause in front of a neutral magistrate. So that was a protection to prohibit general warrants from being enacted. So that's the original purpose. Go ahead.
Well, and then I guess, I mean, the absence of needing the Fourth Amendment after, you know, the idea of we don't have an outside force. I mean, what does the lack of invocation of the Fourth Amendment during the 19th century tell us about the dynamic of policing?
Sure. So there are two things. One is, so the Fourth Amendment applies only to the federal government. Before the 20th century, the federal government didn't really have a police force, a general police force. They had a really small state with very few law enforcement agents that really focused on discrete federal crimes, and there weren't a lot of federal crimes. Most of the crimes were tax evasion types of crimes, treasury crimes. Before the FBI, which is the main law enforcement agency today, the FBI was founded in, I believe, 1908. Before then, most of the law enforcement agents in the federal government were part of the Treasury Department. And so the opportunities for federal law enforcement agents to need to investigate crimes, and it was just not a common occurrence before the 20th century. So you don't really have the Fourth Amendment coming into play all that often. So that's the federal government story. My book also looks at what's going on in the state courts as well, right? Because there are local police departments or local law enforcement agencies at the local and state level, and all states have their version of the Fourth Amendment in their state constitutions. Mm. And so the question is, why don't we see more Fourth Amendment cases at the state level until the 20th century? And there's different reasons for that. Even at the local level, there weren't a really big law enforcement presence. There were sheriffs and constables. Some of the big cities by the mid-19th century did establish police forces, but they weren't as heavily staffed as one might expect. And that's because much of criminal investigation, prosecution, and enforcement was done privately. And what I mean by that is it was often private citizens and private businesses who investigated and prosecuted crime against the people who committed crimes against them. It wasn't a public police department or a public prosecutor. And so the Fourth Amendment really doesn't come into play in those cases either. So the development of modern police forces, which happens in the 20th century, leads to more Fourth Amendment issues. Before then, it didn't really come up.
Well, and that's that leads us to this sort of story of the development of the cars. And I mean, just give us a sense. I couldn't help but think when I was reading about the development, sort of the widespread adoption, I guess we should say, of cars in society, that one of the major sticking points in the libertarian primary, presidential primary debates was the argument that we shouldn't have driver's licenses. Certainly the introduction of cars in the early 1900s I can't remember the statistic off of my top of my head, but the number of like deaths and pedestrian death. I mean, give us a sense of what was going on with cars as they were widely adopted.
Right. So one thing to point out is that the mass production and also the mass adoption of cars happened really quickly. I think the tipping point in terms of a majority of American families who owned a car, you know, getting past the 50%. Tipping point was happened sometime in the mid-1920s. So the infiltration of cars in American society happened really quickly, and cities and towns throughout the country were not prepared for the influx of cars on their streets and highways. So that's one thing. And so what that led to was this mass chaos in terms of traffic jams, in terms of just all of the cars on the streets, but also, like you mentioned, traffic accidents. And the fatalities rate was, it was declared a national crisis by the Secretary of Commerce at the time, Herbert Hoover. There was one statistic that said that from 1913 to 1930, the death rate by car accidents increased, I want to say 400% or something like that. Whereas death by all other types of accidents decreased 40%. And so the traffic accidents from cars made front page news on the New York Times and newspapers throughout the country. It was a really big deal. And immediately towns and cities started regulating the operation of motor vehicles, including driver's licenses.
So, so we have this, we adopt, basically regulations and laws on how to drive and, what constitutes traffic violations for the safety of individuals, but we have no mechanism at that point to enforce it.
Exactly. And everybody violated traffic laws, and it was a huge crisis.
And so, so at that point, what is it, just like a ton of help wanted sign, you know, signs like we need more cops? I mean, like what happens at that point? Because this is the first, I mean, basically the introduction of technology. And on some level, like this is like the story of societies, right? I mean, the introduction of this technology creates a whole almost entire new universe of potential. Like, you know, obviously a lot of positives, but obviously a lot of potential negatives that the only the state is able to step in and in any way, you know, make it function in a way that, you know, there has to be some type of, I guess, for lack of a better term, a monopoly of force here. But there was literally no force to, I guess, execute that monopoly of force.
Right. So one of the main arguments that I make in the first half of my book is to show how American society as a whole shifted its very method of governing society because of cars. We went from a 19th century voluntary association, self-governance types of organizations that govern society to what I call 20th century police law enforcement as a mode of governance. So the problem of how to get people to obey traffic laws, right? How did American society get people to obey laws in the 19th century? It wasn't through police law enforcement. It was through voluntary associations like churches, trade unions, common law courts. People sued each other and, you know, for trespass or contract violations or things like that. Those were the types of means used to make people obey norms of society. And in the first decade and two or so of the automobile, American society tried those 19th century forms of government to get people to obey traffic laws. They had associations like, you know, like the California Development Association, the National Automobile Association, the Traffic Officials Association, all these different associations try to get together to try to convince people to obey laws. People volunteered to direct traffic. They had people, there was a safety pledge drive in California. They tried to get people to sign a safety pledge, pledging their honor that they would obey traffic laws. There was one county in California that put up a billboard saying our speed limit is 30 miles per hour. Be on your honor, obey it, so we don't need to hire more traffic cops. And so these, the whole premise of these voluntary associations is that that citizens are a part of a community and part of the local organization, and you could appeal to their reasonableness or their honor to follow the rules. And they tried that, and it didn't work. And so so towns and cities had to hire more traffic cops. And what they were realizing was that all the fines that they could generate from traffic violations would pay for more traffic officers. And so that's how these modern, I argue, these modern-day police departments grew. It was through traffic law enforcement.
So, and then, I mean, this is fascinating because they start as almost like these, like, you know, I guess, traffic cops.
Exactly.
And it becomes, you write, the first time that the law abiding, for lack of a better term, right? Like just sort of the average citizen who is not causing enough of a problem that other people say, hey, this guy's causing a problem, begin to have interactions with police on a regular basis.
Exactly. And it's actually law-abiding citizen is not, for lack of a better word, it's the phrase that they used themselves in throughout the 20th century. What do we do with these law-abiding citizens who violate traffic laws? So that's a term that they use themselves. And one of the main arguments of my book is, you know, it's surprising to find that the development of modern policing began because of the need to discipline the respectable, ordinary, law-abiding citizen. It wasn't because of the need to discipline the poor, or the foreigners or immigrants, the population that we focus on today in today's literature about the vulnerable population subject to policing. The story, the history of policing, of modern policing, begins with this law-abiding citizenry.
That's fascinating. And then what turns is essentially starts with Carroll v. U.S., right? I mean, this is where, on some level, like, is this the original sin? I don't know, maybe it's not even a sin, but this is where the dynamic changes, where essentially the court can't come up with a better way of doing this than basically allowing police discretion.
Exactly. Carroll versus the United States was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1925. And then what's the U.S. Supreme Court's first Carr case? It actually came up before the U.S. Supreme Court in 1923, but the issue was so hard that they asked for another year. They asked the parties to argue the case again the next year, and they decided it in 1925. And the reason why the issue was so hard was because it's the juxtaposition of these two Carr stories, one about cars and freedom. It democratized transportation to a large numbers of the population. It was, you know, the early adopters of cars were from the law-abiding class. So you have that story about cars and freedom and independence and all of that. But then you also have cars and not just the need for policing, for traffic law regulation and enforcement, but you also have cars that really transformed the commission of crimes. The 1920s, which is when the mass adoption of cars is really gaining speed, 1920s also when national prohibition is becoming enforced, becomes the law of the land. And bootleggers' favorite mode of transporting their liquor was the car, right? The car is basically, one way to think about it is a humongous movable container that can conceal liquor or other contraband. And it's easy to move boxes of liquor inside a car. And so you have law enforcement trying to enforce those laws as well. And so on the other hand, you want to be able to, the court wanted to be able to allow law enforcement to go after bootleggers, gangsters, and all that. So then there's these two different stories about the cars, two tensions that the court was trying to grapple with, and they had a really hard time grappling with it.
And that's the idea that one is like your property, it can't be searched, and the other is that it can't be searched without a warrant, I guess. And the other right. is that the mobility is such that you can't, it's tough to get a warrant because you go
exactly.
to the court and
there's
then
no time to go get one.
They drive off and deliver their liquor.
Exactly.
And so the police are now armed with a certain discretion. And it's like the court's trying to split that difference between the, I guess, the British agents who would come by and just do a total fishing expedition and the idea that, you know, that people could just drive off.
Exactly. So what the court did in the Carroll case was to say, you know, we're going to create a warrant exception for cars, right? Just like you said, cars are private property, and so they are protected by the Fourth Amendment, which requires a specific warrant. But because of the specific, you know, difficulties about cars, they're going to get rid of that warrant requirement. And the requirement is that the officer be able to articulate probable cause. If an officer believes that he or she has probable cause that there's evidence of a crime inside the car, they can stop and search the car without a warrant. And what the huge thing that that decision does is that it transfers the decision of whether there is probable cause from a neutral judge over to an officer. And not just, you know, and that's a huge shift for one thing, but also an officer on the road can decide at that moment whether to stop and search a car. And so I argue this is the first time that the court constitutionally recognizes the legitimacy of police discretionary powers.
And I mean, it's interesting. It just occurs to me that, like, you know, that the sort of the solitude that I guess a police officer would do this in, right? I mean, this is, you know, we're talking about on the road. It's not like there's a high amount of density necessarily, right, where this is happening, or is it? I mean, like the freedom that an officer has at that point seems to be pretty wide berth.
You mean the freedom to decide?
Yeah. Like
what
that.
To do?
Yeah. That.
Yeah. Yeah. This the potential for abuse gets pointed out right after Carroll's decided. One commentator points out, you know, the officer doesn't have to be 100% right that there's evidence of a crime inside the car, right? The standard is just probable cause, which allows room for an officer to be wrong about the fact that there might be evidence of a crime in a car. And so given that wiggle room, an officer could fudge the probable cause determination, right? He could have right. a mere hunch
right.
rather
right.
than probable cause, right? And if that decision gets challenged later in court, one of the commentators said right after the Carroll decision came out, there's something called judicial charity, where judges will be charitable towards the officer's determination of probable cause, especially if they're right, if they turned out to be right, that there was evidence of crime in a car. So right after Carroll, commentators are criticizing the decision for giving too much power, putting too much power into the hands of police officers on the road. And this theme gets picked up again. It gets picked up in 1949 in another Supreme Court case, in a dissent written by Justice Jackson. And he outlines this pretty poignantly. He says, you know, when an officer decides to stop a citizen on the side of the road, it's done in haste, right? A lot of these traffic stops, you know, take place over a few minutes. There's nobody to oversee the whole process. And so the citizen who's pulled over can't ask for a neutral magistrate judge to make sure that everything's kosher. And if it's an innocent person who stopped, and the police let that person go away, then the privacy violations already happened. And the innocent person can't challenge that police action because there's no evidence of crime to challenge. And so innocent people have to experience potentially unconstitutional searches and seizures without ever having a court of law review that. And if you're guilty and there is evidence of a crime, there's, you know, what the commentator said in the 1920s, judicial charity. And so a court is likely to see what the police did as reasonable because, you know, the police was right. There was evidence of a crime.
And
so Justice Jackson was worried about how the way that the Carroll decision played out in practice would erode Fourth Amendment rights over that Fourth Amendment rights in cars.
And the problem then becomes, like, there's really two scenarios where that erosion becomes really problematic, I mean, broadly. And that is, one, you either get a bunch of police who are, you know, who become obsessed with their power and decide to do this to everybody across the board, or it becomes a mechanism in which to, I guess, act upon racial bias that you have, and that ends up being the problem.
Right, and we see that play out in the history of policing cars. There's two stories that are, well, several stories that are coming together at this point, and one is, you know, the criminal laws get developed over the 20th century. We had prohibition that lasted for a little over a decade. And then after that, we had various drug laws, which turned increasingly punitive after the 1970s. To enforce those laws, a lot of it, which happened in the context of cars, officers need probable cause, and it's becoming increasingly easier to meet that standard of probable cause. But in a way, officers don't even need to articulate probable cause that there's evidence of a crime because, and this is the early history picking back up again, there's all these traffic laws that everybody's violating. And so the police can basically pull over anybody for a traffic violation. And in the starting in the 1950s, you see stories, or there are stories in the NAACP archives of the police using minor traffic violations to harass and abuse NAACP lawyers and activists. And one famous story is how Thurgood Marshall was pulled over for a pretextual stop, right? And Martin Luther King was pulled over for a speeding ticket. And there's all these stories in the NAACP archives of people who park right outside the NAACP offices who are ticketed for a minor traffic violation. And so there are these stories about the stories of traffic law enforcement and criminal law enforcement are coming together pretty early in the 20th century.
And so does this, I mean, it feels like that this slippery slope, I guess, which was a slippery slope, I mean, on some level, that the only thing that in some way seemed to at least plateau it, I guess, was really in many respects the advent of cell phones. And perhaps, you know, it seems like the case law has actually probably continued down that slope a little bit in terms of allowing police these powers. Not the least of which is their ability to confiscate goods if they suspect you involved in drugs in some instances, almost like a pre-punishment. But there's also, it seems to me, to be the problem that this dynamic this principle in terms of giving the police discretion crosses outside of traffic and cars into just policing more generally, like when you start to get like stop and frisk and stuff like that. Is that part of the story?
It is. And I talk about some of the new data privacy cases in my epilogue, because I do see old themes about the cars popping up in these new cases about smartphones and data privacy in interesting ways. And so, for example, one of the themes of these Fourth Amendment cases in the 20th century about policing cars, one of the common themes is every man or the law-abiding citizen, right? If the courts allow the police to do this, then that means the court, then that means that the police can also harass the every man or the law-abiding citizen. And this was a theme that was made by Carroll in 1925. His lawyer argued, you know, if you allow the police to do this, who else is going to be harassed? The rural postman, the milkman, the every man. In 1949, Justice Jackson also said we have to treat the search of this bootlegger as a search of every man. And so there's this, because of the way that the car democratized mobility, lurking behind these court opinions is how is this court opinion also going to apply to everybody else? And I see that theme coming up again in the smartphone cases where the court's opinions point out so many of us have smartphones, and the justices are probably thinking, I have one too, right? And so in the one of the last smartphone decisions, Riley versus California, the opinion points out like 90% of Americans own a smartphone. So whatever we allow the police to do in this case is going to affect everybody. So that's one of the themes that that are coming up again. The other interesting theme that I see, which is kind of a deviation from the history of policing cars, is comes from one argument that I make in my book, that the conventional story that we have been told about the Fourth Amendment is a story of progress and triumph, where the courts are in a, have been in a position to expand individual rights and protect individuals from the police. That was a story I was told when I went to law school. And it's a story that really focuses on the Warren Court. The Warren Court was the court under the Chief Justice, Earl Warren, mostly in the 1960s, one of the most liberal courts in U.S. history. That was the court that decided Brown v. Board of Education, that eliminated or said segregation in public schools was unlawful or unconstitutional. And the Warren Court was also the court that started the due process revolution. Right? We call it a revolution because the court basically started applying the U.S. Constitution, which only applies to the federal government. They started applying it to local police officers. And so the U.S. Supreme Court started policing the police. It was a huge revolution. And it's a story of triumph, basically. That was a story that I've had for ever since in law school. And what I realized when I read all those cases, those landmark cases that we celebrate for protecting individual rights, all of those cases don't have anything to do with policing cars. They're all about protecting the home or the house, which is the most protected space in constitutional law. And when I started looking at all the other Fourth Amendment cases that even the Warren Court decided about policing cars, it's in the car cases where the court actually expanded the police's discretionary power. So it's that my book kind of revises a little bit the standard story about what the courts did in terms of developing the Fourth Amendment in the 20th century. So I go into all of this to say how the smartphone jurisprudence is deviating from the history of policing cars. What the court said in one of the last smartphone cases is to say smartphones is actually not like cars. Usually anything that you could put into a car is considered part of a car search. Like if you have a purse inside your car, that can be searched as part of a car search. And so one would think that a smartphone in your car could be searched as, it's found inside the car. But instead what the court said was, you know, a smartphone is more like your house because it contains books. It contains more books than a smartphone. The smartphone has more books than when many people have in their homes. Mm. It contains medical records that you might keep right. a safeguard in your home. It has, you know, conversations with friends and texts, and conversations with friends can happen in the home. So what the court did was to say smartphones are not like cars, it's more like houses. And therefore, we're going to require a warrant if the police want to search your smartphone. And so that metaphor of is it more like a car or is it more like a house still shapes how the court decides whether the Fourth Amendment is going to apply to different and new technologies.
Fascinating. The book is Policing the Open Road, How Cars Transformed American Freedom. Sarah Seo, thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to the book on majority.fm.
Thank you so much. This was a great pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. I thought I did well, too. Are you familiar with the Catch-a-Killer box? Great fun for you and your family. And most importantly, you were talking about screens. No screens. Traditional fun board game. It's a board game.
All right, folks, we're going to go to the fun half where we will do what we do. Play sound, give you some stories, going to give you an update on what's going on in Ecuador and some context around the uprising there. Obvious point, but worth making. How much romance and focus on the Hong Kong protests in the U.S. in the U.S. press, and basically none to very little on the Ecuadorian protests, and certainly not what it is covered as a question of basic urgency for the democratic and economic rights of, as an example, the indigenous people of Ecuador. Look up Chomsky. All right, so we'll do all of that in the fun half. Become a member of the Majority Report today at majority.fm/become a member. That's how this whole thing happens. Your support is vitally needed for all enterprises. Solidarity with our friends at Splinter. Terrible news. And a real reminder about the importance of independent media and your role in it. Check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade, tea, coffee, or chocolate. On Tuesday's Michael Brooks Show, we had a really interesting debate with Sagar and Jetty about China and the difference between nationalism and democratic socialism as a framework for understanding the world. Heidi Sloan, DSA candidate in Texas's 25th. We talked about ending homelessness, farming, Medicare for all, and I gave an intro to the idea of hegemony, Gramsci, and what that actually means for real political work in the 21st century, plus Ecuador and a whole bunch else. We really cover a huge amount of ground. Next week, instead of Tuesday, because there's going to be a presidential debate, we're going to have a Wednesday show, and that will be pretty heavy on the recap. Crystal Ball is going to call in, regular on our show from Rising. We're going to talk about it, and then Ryan Grimm is going to join us in studio. Patreon.com/TMBS.
AKA He of Jesse Waters' Nightmares.
He of Jesse Waters' Nightmares. We will probably spend 30 minutes recounting him stepping to the extremely unfunny Jesse Waters. And also this weekend for patrons, patreon.com/TMBS, a primer and illicit history of Narendra Modi and the Indian authoritarian moment, how it sells itself globally. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Also, guys, we're about to be a month out from the Philadelphia Live Show, and that is usually, for whatever reason, for TMBS live shows, there's a huge spike out of the gate. Then there's like a steady, slow pace of like a couple a day. And then a lot of people seem to like to wait the last couple of weeks. And sometimes that actually does mean, like, you know, it's a tricky situation if you come to the door, as an example. So I would go click on the link we have on the Majority.fm homepage and get your tickets to World Cafe, November 23rd, Michael Brooks Show Live. Matt, talk to us.
Yeah, folks, check out Literary Hangover. All the episodes are up on YouTube, so subscribe to that if you prefer that as your medium.
How many subs do you have on YouTube now?
I think close to 3,000. Slowly up there. Nice. I mean, it's just the audio thing. I am going to do some... I'm skeptical of Twitch. I do want to get to Twitch, but I also might do some streaming Let's Play style on my Literary Hangover YouTube page. So go check that out, folks. Subscribe.
Awesome. See you guys in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, back. Back, back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Homo says what?
What?
Homo says what?
Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black Africans. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
See Donald Trump out there? Doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on.
What? Come on.
What?
Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, 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 pussy.
Hey, folks, just a reminder, the show is sponsored by Hunt a Killer. Hunt a Killer is the murder mystery subscription box that immerses you in an ongoing detective experience. With every delivery, you're going to sift through an elaborate case file and evidence. You'll eliminate suspects until you crack the case and catch the killer. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. Hurry, take advantage of this offer, embrace your inner detective. huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. That's huntakiller.com/majority.